Today, we hear from Lisa Nandy in the first of a series of interviews with all three Labour leadership candidates. And is coronavirus going to cause a global recession?
Our exit poll is suggesting that there will be a Conservative majority when all the votes are counted after this election of December 2019. And that will be the biggest Conservative majority since Margaret Thatcher's third victory back in 1987, the worst Labour result in modern times.
Let me just show you one MP from Don Valley, Caroline Flint. She says we're going to hear the Corbynistas blaming it on Brexit and the Labour Uber Remainers blaming Corbyn. Both are to blame for what looks like a terrible night for Labour.
We're entering the Boris Johnson era of British politics. He is going to be Prime Minister for many, many years to come.
He'll be allowed to get away with chaos and uncertainty if Labour doesn't get its act together. But at the moment, it's in a catastrophic place.
I will not lead the party in any future general election campaign.
Are you going to stand for leadership of the Labour Party?
The honest answer is that I'm seriously thinking about it. We've just had the most shattering defeat where you really felt in towns like mine that the earth was quaking, and we've watched the entire Labour base just crumble beneath our feet.
We cannot fight the Tories if we're fighting each other. Factionalism has to go.
And I will fight for modern democratic public ownership. I will fight for all of these things. And that is why I am standing to become the leader of the Labour Party.
The Labour Party faces an immense challenge. Having lost four elections and millions of votes, it now has to find ways to oppose Boris Johnson's Conservative government with its landslide majority of 80. But first, it has to choose a new leader. This month, we will be interviewing the three candidates who think it should be them and telling the story of a moment or idea which helps us to understand what type of leader they would be. From The Guardian, I'm Anushka Astana. Today in Focus, Lisa Nandy's pitch for the Labour leadership. Lisa Nandy, you grew up in Manchester and then Bury in Greater Manchester, and then after university in Newcastle, moved south. What was it like growing up? Did you have a sense that you would leave the Northwest?
It was a very angry time when I was growing up. I was born in 79, the year that Margaret Thatcher came to power. The race riots, I don't remember them, but I was 2 or 3 years old when they happened in Moss Side.
Moss Side in the summer sunshine looks deceptively peaceful with its rows of neat-looking new houses. It's only when you come down to street level that the scars of the recent rioting remain.
My dad and others have been very involved in trying to sort that out and to change the narrative around what had happened.
The boarded-up shops, some will never reopen. When you talk to the people, they tell how dislike of the police and the angry jobless youngsters are still here, and future trouble can't be ruled out.
For a lot of young people growing up in Moss Side, particularly young men, police brutality and huge unemployment, you know, lack of prospects. These were all things that were feeding into a sense that the world was sort of falling apart, really. And we had a government that was closing down the industry around the outskirts of Greater Manchester. We were watching public services falling apart, rough sleeping on the streets. You know, a lot of the things that we see now were happening then.
Okay, so you're in your 20s, you moved to London, and in 2006 you became a councillor for the Labour Party in Hammersmith. At a similar time, you also became a senior policy advisor at the Children's Society charity that supports vulnerable children. Is that where you became passionate about the rights of refugees?
It was earlier than that. I went off to work for Centrepoint, which is a youth homelessness organisation, worked with homeless teenagers in Soho. And during that time, the last Labour government was doing amazing things for children leaving care. But the opposite was true of child refugees and asylum seekers.
Tony Blair recently promised to cut the number of asylum seekers in half by September. Refusing benefits if claims weren't made straight away was one of the ways ministers hoped to hit that target.
and we had so many unaccompanied asylum-seeking children ending up sleeping rough on the streets. I just thought it was appalling. Those kids were brave, they were brilliant, and we had a government that was locking them up in immigration detention, that was starving them out of the country by removing their benefits.
I've seen over 65 clients who have been homeless and destitute in my office. In appalling conditions, freezing cold winter. It's just not acceptable. The courts have made it clear over 7 years that they will not allow a system where asylum seekers are intended deliberately to starve while their asylum claims are being determined.
I was just absolutely determined that we were going to change that. And so that's why I went to work for Children's Society, because they were doing a lot of work with child refugees. It's probably still the most incredible job that I've ever had.
And you took the government, the Labour government at the time, to court.
Yeah, it was quite a weird sort of few years, really, because by day I was taking the Labour government to court and battling them on the treatment of those kids. And by night I was a Labour councillor in Hammersmith, you know, defending plans to build more housing and taking on the Tories.
Just at that time in your kind of career, you see the opportunity to run for a seat and you go for Wigan. Why there?
Well, every year I had to go to all three party conferences for work. I mean, you'll probably feel the pain about this.
Yes.
And I'd gone to Tory party conference. It was 2009 and it was in Manchester. And I got off the train in the city that I grew up in and just saw Tories everywhere.
It was conference.
It was conference. But
they
you
went
know,
from Manchester.
They were really present. I mean, they were there and they were loud and vocal. One of them was complaining about the lack of taxis as I got off the train. And I just thought, how is this happening in my city? They were so confident. It was at the time when we all thought they were going to win the election. And I had a meeting with Michael Gove and his special advisor, who explained that they were going to scrap the child poverty targets. And I was just horrified by the whole thing. I just thought, what am I going to be able to do for the young people that we work with? I've got to get on the front line and fight this. And then Wigan came up a few weeks later, and it's Lancashire. So it's just down the road from where I'd spent my teenage years in Bury, where all my family, step family still are. So it seemed like a bit of a sort of long shot, but I thought I'd never forgive myself if I didn't try. And a few weeks later, I found myself in the Houses of Parliament.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Can I thank the Secretary of State for her kind words and say what a pleasure it is to...
And that was in 2010. And you'd kind of come full circle. You started in Bury in Greater Manchester, moved to London, and then came back this time to Wigan as an MP. What did that mean for your day-to-day life?
The biggest problem that I've had in the last few years, to be honest, is the London-centric nature of politics. So I live in Wigan. I'm the MP for Wigan. I use the same schools, hospitals, roads, buses. All these things really matter to me because I have the same experience as my constituents. And I spent a year commuting backwards and forwards with a three-month-old baby that I was still breastfeeding. And the drive to suck us into London, sitting on the political shows on a Sunday morning, so it means you're there all weekend and then being in Parliament Monday to Friday, is just, it's almost overwhelming. You have to be really tough to withstand it. The London-centric nature of politics, I think, is absolutely killing us. And it's one of the reasons why I said I wanted to move Labour HQ out of London as one
to
of
Warrington.
First bridges. Yeah, and you would think the sky had fallen in. This has been by far the most controversial thing I've said in this contest, worse than scrapping the monarchy.
I'm sure there are hundreds of stories from your time as an MP in Wigan, all sorts of different issues that you've had to deal with on a daily basis. But one thing we're trying to do in our series of interviews with Labour leadership candidates is to zoom in on one specific story from your life, which we hope might enlighten us in some ways about your view of the world, what you stand for and what is driving you. And we thought one story that might do that for you is what happened in Wigan in 2015 when a storm erupted locally after 100 refugees were placed in a local hotel.
You get caught up in fancy hotels like this, where people on holiday pay hundreds of pounds to stay at. They do that for nothing. They're spending all of our taxpayers' money on nonsense things that we don't even agree with, like asylum seekers being looked after.
What happened?
We had a phone call into the office from somebody saying, have you heard about the asylum seekers in Standish? a small village on the outskirts of Wigan and looked back through our correspondence. We hadn't had anything about it. So I sort of made a few phone calls. And it turned out that the night before, Serco, who were the private company that the Home Office uses to accommodate asylum seekers, had moved about 100 young men, mainly from Africa, into the Britannia Hotel in Standish. It's a really nice village where a lot of families live and have lived for a long time. And they've got a thriving community forum that is never shy of telling me what they think, which is painful at times, but also really important. It's a genuinely nice place, and there's a hotel on the outskirts of it. And Serco had bought up places in this hotel because there were a lot of Syrian refugees coming to Britain at the time, more than they could accommodate, and they'd bought up this hotel. They'd given no warning at all that this was about to happen. So straight away, we were getting phone calls from people saying, what's happening in Standish? They were like, there are people everywhere. There are young men everywhere. One woman said to me, there's one in the co-op. And I said to her, well, have you spoken to him? And she said, no, do you think I should? Anyway, she rang back and said he was all right. She'd had a chat to him and he was all right. He knew where he was going. But overnight, the whole place changed and nobody knew why. And as you would expect, very, very quickly, the far right got a hold of this. Rumours being spread about how the young men in the hotel had been involved in crime, violent crime, that the children at the local school weren't safe, that they'd been hanging around the school, that they'd broken into a church. You know, the usual sort of rumours that the far right will often use online forums to spread. It almost felt like a situation that was about to blow.
It's one thing that the far right come and they make up rumours and try and stir things up. But it's also for a small village to suddenly move 100 asylum seekers into what had been a kind of luxury hotel. Must have been a shock for people. I mean, what were locals saying to you? They must have had genuine concerns.
So we had a few people that got in touch with the office. I could probably count them on the fingers of both hands, who were just, it was just pure racism. They were just very, very angry about the fact that asylum seekers had been placed into the village. But I think it was just, people were just baffled, to be honest. I mean, if you moved 100 people onto my street, I would be wondering what on earth had just happened. And credit to a lot of the people in the village who rang the office and were saying, we want to understand why this has happened, rather than just believing the rubbish that was being written online. But they also wanted to hear from the community leaders, including me, what was actually going on. And because of the way that the Home Office and Serco had handled it, none of us knew. And so the first job was to try and find out what on earth was going on, and then to get a community response together. We did a public meeting, and it was mainly just people who just wanted to understand why it had happened, how long they were staying, who was paying for it. They were worried about the impact that it would have on local schools. One of the things that people were really worried about was that a lot of the young men who were placed there had been involved in war. Some of them had been child soldiers. So they were really concerned about mental health support and whether the community was going to be safe with people who didn't have any support at all. You know, was it true that there'd been a rise in crime? The police said, yes, there's been one hate incident since it happened. It was one of the far right who threatened the asylum seekers and we've arrested them for it. But apart from that, all of the rumours that circulated were completely untrue. And so really fast, the conversation turned to, well, who's helping them? And off the back of the meeting, one of the councillors got so upset by what had happened, and particularly the way in which some of these far-right activists had tried to characterise Wigan as an intolerant, unwelcoming place, that he launched an appeal with the council for the Syrian refugees. And we got 36,000 bags of donations across the borough in just 2 weeks. So in a lot of ways, it was a really big moment, I think, for us, because for me in particular, as the town's MP, what it showed me was that I was able to give a voice to people, the decent, silent majority out there, who weren't being heard at all until we stepped forward and allowed them to be heard. And that's really, really important for the Labour Party at this moment, because I think we've got into a place where we've allowed different parts of the country to be characterised. The Remain voting graduates in the cities are somehow liberal, cosmopolitan elites who don't care about communities and don't care about other parts of the country. And the Leave voting working class towns outside of London are places where people are xenophobic or racist and don't share our values. None of this is true. And we've got to do better than this if we're going to piece the country back together again.
So basically what you're telling me is that you managed to persuade the people in the village that the refugees should in principle be welcome in Wigan.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was already there, to be honest. Like where I grew up in Bury, it's a mill town. And when the Indian cotton pickers went on strike, a lot of mill workers in Lancashire went out on strike in solidarity with them. There were members of my family over in India who were involved in that strike. And there were members of my stepfamily in Lancashire who were involved in that strike as well. These are the two halves of my family on different sides of the world coming together and standing together. Some of those mill workers were starving in order to show that level of solidarity, but they did it because they believed it was the right thing. And in the end, it was the only way that working people were going to succeed. So those values have always been there. And we've allowed the referendum to become this moment where we sort of start to write off half of the country. And I feel very strongly about it because it devalues who we are as a people and it divides us unnecessarily from one another. And what was really important about that meeting, though, was that we gave people the sense of security and control. And it tells me that when people feel secure and empowered, that's when we do well as a country. And I think that there's been a deliberate attempt on the right of British politics, including from large sections of the Tory party, to whip up that fear about one another in this country in recent years. And there's a yearning in every nation and region of this country, I think, to pull together and to move forwards together. But at the moment, if you look across the political landscape, where is it coming from? And I'm determined that Labour's going to be that party.
What happened to the asylum seekers?
There was a moment where Serco decided not to carry on the contract with the Britannia. I had been pushing them for some time to end that contract because it just didn't seem at all appropriate to have young men. And by that point, there were some families in there as well, confined to their rooms, with very little support still.
So you were pushing it from the kind of humanitarian angle.
A lot of those young men should have been in supported accommodation and the families should have been in family accommodation. The idea of being accommodated en masse, it's quite dehumanising and it's also very unsustainable for the local area because especially where you've got families, they need access to health facilities, they need access to schools. So you need a much better system that actually puts people at the heart of it. But eventually they decided not to continue with the contract. We still have an asylum population in Wigan. It's local people who set up our Support for Wigan Arrivals project, which is still going from strength to strength.
I mean, it seems to me that the example of the Britannia Hotel kind of feeds into a lot of your ideas around localism and kind of steeping things within the community. But localism isn't always going to be as easy as that because there are value divides, even if they're not as simple as some of the kind of stereotypes that you've outlined. I mean, what would you have done if your community had wanted to oppose the outcome you were pushing for? Would you have, in that situation, under the kind of mantra of localism, accepted that and represented it?
Well, I mean, I've got an example of where that's happened in recent years because I campaigned for Remain and my community voted by 2-1 to leave. But there are times when you just got to stand up for your principles. And I've never, ever made any secret from my constituents that I'm a Remainer and that I still want to remain. And even at the point where it got really unpopular to be fighting for a deal with the EU, I was standing up and making that case back home.
The truth is that this is the right thing to do. There are people in my constituency, very many of them, a third of whom voted Remain, who now want to see us just stop this process altogether. And there are a number of people now, I would say the most significant group, who want to cut all ties and leave the EU altogether. They shout louder than the others, and they often drown out those voices calling for consensus. But it is my job to make sure that they don't. Because they
it's been a really rough few years from that point of view. In London, I might be seen as a leaver who was trying to drive us off a cliff, but in Wigan, I'm seen largely as a Remainer who's trying to block Brexit because I was seeking a deal. And I've had to stand up to that and say no deal will be a disaster on every level.
Recovered. I will not let those small...
I suppose the point is that there's no substitute for winning the argument. And the reason that I believe in localism is not just because I think that people are fundamentally decent and in the end, if you give people choices, they'll make the progressive decision. But because if they're not making the progressive decision, then it tells you that you're getting it wrong and that you've got to go out and redouble your efforts to win the argument.
I mean, you do get critiqued on both sides of the divide for trying to have your cake and eat it. I mean, just a couple of examples. David Goodhart, the commentator and author who was on the left but has argued for some time that Labour has been failing its traditional voters, has written specifically about that hotel example and said that you shamed locals into not asking the African asylum seekers to be housed somewhere else and that you can't be, his words not mine, both the communitarian fighting for people in Wigan and the internationalist who is relaxed about migration levels. My colleague here, Nesrin Malik, on a very different side of this debate, says you can't magically do two opposing things at the same time. You can't legitimise what she calls people's unfounded and xenophobic fears about immigration while also leading them out of that state into a promised land in one, again, her words, big racism conversion therapy session.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with Nasreen that you can't play into the sort of dog whistle politics around immigration and then hope to create a more liberal, progressive, decent, compassionate society. But I've never done that. And one of the things that I think people like her profoundly underestimate is that I stand up for these values, especially where it's hard. That's what I've done all my political career, whether I'm fighting the last Labour government over their treatment of asylum seekers whilst being a Labour councillor as well, or whether I'm saying to people, you know, who are threatening to kill me back at home, I am not going to allow this sort of racist, derogatory language around asylum. I'm not going to allow the EU referendum to become a moment where far-right activists and far-right values take hold. But when you do stand up for that and you do give voice to that, people come forwards who are profoundly relieved to hear those values expressed on behalf of their town and are determined to make their voices heard as well. And that is politics. That is leadership. That is what you've got to do. And I do get a bit frustrated, if I'm honest, with people like David, who lives in Islington, writing about people who live in other parts of the country. There's an arrogance behind that that is frankly unacceptable. I wouldn't presume to write about and know better about the situation of people who live in very different parts of the country to me and who have had very, very different lived experiences to me. I wouldn't presume to know better than they do who they are or what their values are. And to write off people in my community and caricature them as something that they're not, I find it profoundly offensive. You are writing out of history, the history of hundreds of years of international solidarity, of standing up to racism, of compassion and decency and tolerance that you find in every working class community in this country.
I mean, you've spent years thinking about towns and saying that towns have been ignored. So you must think that there is something that is different in the cities that Labour represents and the towns that it represents.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, the thing that's completely different is the experience of the last 40 years. It's the fact that good jobs were lost in those towns, that young people then had to make a decision whether to move in order to get opportunities to work and study. They had to move to the cities because that's where the investment had gone, not just under the Tories, but under the last Labour government. There was huge investment that went into places like Manchester in order that the benefits would trickle out and we'd regenerate our regional economies. But it worked for parts of Manchester. It didn't work outside of there. And so what you've seen is a story of relative economic decline over 40 years in those places. Young people going, older people growing alone hundreds of miles away from children and grandchildren, the spending power ripped out of the community. So the high streets are falling apart, the buses have gone, the pubs have closed. These things really matter to people. And where those young people have gone to, the cities, you've got huge air pollution, high housing prices, lots of young people in debt, strain on public services, and massive inequality because cities just can't simply deal with the amount of growth that they've had. it's two sides of the same coin. And the experiences might be very different, but actually the solution is the same. The solution is to get investment back into those areas so that young people have choices. And the only way to achieve that is actually to get power out of central London and into all of those places.
What does that look like? What does that power look like?
It looks like instead of Grant Shapps or, God help us, Chris Grayling deciding how we run our railways, it looks much more like Andy Burnham and the town and city leaders across the north being able to make decisions about the transport network that we need.
But given some of the complexities that you yourself have outlined, your kind of thesis about how Labour has for years been way too London-centric and not thought about the towns around this country, what does it mean in national terms, national policy terms on things like immigration?
Well, on immigration, it means be honest about what you believe and go out and win the argument. I've always said to my constituents back home, I believe in immigration, I believe in free movement, I believe in investing in the skills of young people here as well, so that this doesn't become a zero-sum game.
But the polls don't suggest that people in large parts of the country that you want to win back necessarily agree with you on that.
Well, no, because if you ask people, do you support free movement, then people may well say no. But then when you ask them, as I have, why, somebody said to me during the referendum, because you're saying that it's good that we can get people to come and work at the local hospital, and I'm glad that we can, and I agree with you, but you've just abolished the nursing bursary and the education maintenance allowance and university grants, and so my kids haven't got a hope of working at that hospital. How is that fair? And she's right. She's right that we should do both.
If you get this job, you're going to have local elections straight away. The BBC have got an internal Labour Party memo warning that the party faces an absolute drubbing. It's an incredibly stressful job at an unbelievably difficult time. Why on earth would you want this role?
Because there's no choice. Because I could see how this was shaping up in the run-up to the general election. I could see that our entire Labour base was going to collapse in every nation and region of the UK. These are places where Labour has run through people's family history for the last 100 years, and it's deeply emotional, this break. And we've got to sort this out. I genuinely believe we could be back in power in 4 years' time. Politics has never moved at this speed before. Things have changed very fast. They could change again. And we've got to get it right. If we don't get it right, the consequences, not just for Labour, but for the country, are so profound. We don't get another chance.
Lisa, thank you very much.
Thanks.
That was Lisa Nandy. If you want to hear more about this race, then listen to our episode, Who Should Lead Labour, from the recent Guardian Live hustings that I hosted. Next up in our series, Rebecca Long-Bailey. Coming up, how is the coronavirus epidemic hitting the global economy, and how might that affect you? Now, we've seen havoc on the global financial markets driven in part by fears over the impact of coronavirus travel restrictions. The Guardian's financial editor, Niels Prattley, spoke to us as the UK markets closed on Monday evening.
It's been a crazy day for share prices in London and Wall Street. A lot of selling across the board and very reminiscent of 2008 and the days after the collapse of Lehman Brothers. We sort of knew when we woke up on Monday morning that something big was going to happen, because we'd already seen stock markets in the Far East fall heavily. But the selling continued in London and indeed intensified, the FTSE 100 off 7.7% and then ricocheting through to New York, where there was absolutely no relief. The Dow and the S&P 500 index both down about 6%. This has been the culmination really of a 2 week reappraisal by the markets of the seriousness of the coronavirus outbreak. At first, maybe 2 or 3 weeks ago, investors thought this was a China-only affair that would be over in 3 months or so. Now they're having to wake up to the reality of the situation. They're also having to wake up to the reality of a price war in the oil market, which has knocked about 20% off the price of a barrel of oil on Monday. Some of these hits at individual companies have not been seen for years and years. For example, 19% off BP share prices, the sort of thing you would not expect to see in a decade or 2 decades of covering markets. I mean, these are really substantial moves, a lot of stock market value going in an instant, and will be substantial parts of the portfolio of most people who save for a pension in this country. The real shock was twofold. One, the price war on oil, and second, the restrictions that are being put on the movement of Italian citizens in the north of the country. That is a new factor and a shocking factor that markets have had to digest. You can see immediately how that is going to affect the finances, say, of European airlines and indeed of transatlantic airlines and global airlines. You can also see potentially hits to retailers if people don't want to go to shops, and if consumer confidence is affected, you can see a reluctance for manufacturers to invest if they don't know what the demand outlook is going to be. And if they're not sure that their supply chain, if they're getting goods from China or from Northern Europe, there will be a reluctance to invest. Everything goes on pause until there is more clarity. It's probably fair to say that the market is now expecting a global recession this year. That's certainly what share prices are saying. Governments have got a problem here. They've got a problem at several levels. Most obviously, there's a healthcare crisis, and that clearly is the priority. The secondary problem is how to manage the fallout from the economy. And we're already looking at what's called fiscal measures, spending measures, and those could be supplemented by, say, telling the banks to go easy on loans for distressed companies that would be healthy were it not for the coronavirus outbreak. You can guarantee contracts for some companies. You can guarantee credit for some companies. You could try and minimise the fallout from this in lots of ways. And that's one of the challenges that's going to face the Chancellor this week when he does his budget on Wednesday. One of the things that the markets will be looking for in the days and the weeks ahead is a bit of a sign of global coordination by governments and by policymakers. In 2008, the markets began to turn. There was a famous G10 summit in which the big governments really resolved to rescue the banking system and then put in place measures to aid a recovery. We haven't seen any coordinated action really so far. One reason is because it's quite hard to do. But this is the sort of thing that investors will be looking for in the days ahead. The effect on ordinary savers in this country, to the extent that they're invested in shares, which will be most people who are saving for a pension or investing via an ISA. As always in this situation, a good time to have sold would have been about 2 weeks ago. People often ask, should I still be selling now? Now, I'm not going to answer that question, but I do think if you are looking for the long term, if you're saving for retirement, the time to keep your eye on the long term is when it is most painful to do so.
That was Niels Prattley. Do read about this on the website. That's all for now. My thanks to Lisa Nandy and Niels Prattley. This episode was produced by Josh Kelly, Rose Della Rabiti and Courtney Youssef. Sound design was by Nicholas Cox. The executive producers are Phil Maynard and Nicole Jackson. We'll be back tomorrow.